This is the Partners for Progressive Israel podcast. Welcome and thank you for listening. I'm your host, Nicole Cooper, recording from Jerusalem. In this episode, I talk with Jeff Halper, the co-founder and director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions and long-term peace activist. He's well known as a nonviolent, direct action-oriented activist with a track record for civil disobedience. We talk today about how the Israeli authorities' practice of house demolitions is a pathway to understanding the conflict. It leads us into a conversation about how liberal Zionism needs to be reevaluated in its principles and structures to ensure a peaceful future. We talk about the dynamics of the occupation, the Palestinian right of return, and why a singular binational state is a contender for the future of Israel and Palestine.
Well, hello.
Hello.
Welcome, and thanks for joining me.
Pleasure to be here so far.
Yeah. Can you just introduce yourself, who you are, what about yourself?
I'm Jeff Halper. I'm the head of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, which is an Israeli peace and human rights organization, but very political, that's dedicated really to ending the Israeli occupation entirely, which used to be a code for a two-state solution that we believe is gone. We'll talk about that later. Mm-hmm. But certainly we are trying to work towards formulating what a just and what a just peace between Israelis and Palestinians would look like. That's really it. We're a big picture kind of organization. We use the issue of house demolitions that we'll talk about as a vehicle for exposing how the occupation works, what Israel's intentions are, and so on. But our goal is really to try to help formulate with our Palestinian partners what a just peace would look like.
So why is house demolitions the thing to focus on to connect all of the structures of occupation?
Right. Well, we kind of backed into it, actually. We began our work in 1997. It's almost 20 years ago, when Netanyahu was elected for the first time in 96. Rabin had just been assassinated. Rabin was elected, and Netanyahu was elected on an explicitly anti-Oslo peace process program. So in a sense, his election was a rejection by the Israeli public of the Oslo peace process. With all that meant, and what it meant was that the occupation reasserted itself in a very brutal kind of a way. House demolitions, it had never really stopped, came back. The expropriation of territories, you had the whole economic closure being reinforced. And it was obvious that even though the Oslo peace process limped on for another couple of years, that it was over. And that in fact, Israel had never intended a Palestinian state or to really see through this so-called peace process. But, you know, like a lot of Israelis, we in the peace movement, and I'm talking about the critical peace movement, sometimes we call ourselves, some of us are anti-Zionists, some are non-Zionists, or simply Israelis. We try, you know, it's very hard to frame ourselves in terms of an Israeli perspective, a Zionist perspective, because Zionism is an ideology. And it's an important part of Israeli culture and Israeli politics and so on, but it's only one element. You can't define a country by an ideology and straitjacket it. So certainly Zionism, I mean, the fact we're here, the fact that I moved to this country means that there's something Zionistic in that. But I think we would define ourselves, certainly the younger generation of activists would define themselves simply as Israelis. But what I mean by anti or non-Zionist or post-Zionist is that unlike liberal Zionists that insist that Israel be a Jewish country, that are committed to a two-state solution, they can't go anywhere else. We're not. We're committed to being Israelis. We want to keep the Hebrew language and the Hebrew university and Hebrew literature and culture and all of that. But we can envision one democratic state with the Palestinians. And not only envision it, but I think that realistically, that's the only way out of this conflict. And so that sets us in a very different place politically from the liberal Zionists, in that if you look at J Street and you look at the more liberal, even Meretz here, they want peace and they recognize Palestinian rights, but they can't go beyond the two-state solution. And the problem is the two-state solution is gone. And so you end up having good intentions but not having anywhere to go politically, and you get defensive and you get assertive to some degree and all of that. So that that's really the part of the left that we belong to. So that we saw that the Oslo peace process was in a state of collapse. Nevertheless, like I said, like other Israelis, we had kind of invested hopes that maybe it would work. You know, sides were meeting and so on. But when Netanyahu was elected, that was our wake-up call, that it's not going to happen. And so we decided to kind of engage in resisting the occupation that obviously was not going to end. Now, it's true. What do we do? I mean, we haven't really been active for a number of years. So we went out and talked to a lot of our Palestinian partners. I'm an anthropologist. I was a part of the group. So part of anthropology is going to talk to the people. And the issue of house demolitions came up all the time. It wasn't something we were very familiar with. We knew it was happening, but we didn't know very much about it. And I have to admit, as Israeli activists, we didn't know much at all about really the nuts and bolts of the occupation, where places were, what the mechanisms were for demolishing or for deciding on this policy or that policy. We didn't know really much. The issue of house demolitions is brought up all the time by Palestinians. It was one of the most painful parts of the occupation. So we decided to take the issue of house demolitions as the focus of our work as activists. I mean, we didn't really think beyond that. This is the issue we'll focus on, and we started to do that. but I think over time, what happened was, as we started to know Palestinians, as we started to realize and understand and learn how the policies were made, what in the hell the civil administration was, and who issues demolition orders, and why, and what are the intentions, and who's being demolished, and we began to really learn the lay of the land. And I think what we learned was that house demolitions was actually the essence of the conflict. We had backed into it, I think, without understanding the full implications. And that is that if you deny people the right to a home, and the word in English, home and homeland, are connected. So if you deny people a home individually, but you deny a people a homeland collectively, the message really is get out. You have no place in this country. And that was the meaning of house demolitions. Now, until today, Israel's demolished something like 46,000 Palestinian homes in the occupied territory since 1967. What we have to remember is in 1947-48, during the Nakba, or what we call the War of Independence, Israel demolished at least 52,000 Palestinian homes inside what became Israel. We're talking about entire villages, entire towns, entire urban areas. Something like 531 entire communities were destroyed systematically. In other words, not in the heat of battle. It wasn't collateral damage from fighting. The people had left. They had fled their villages or been driven out. And over the course of years, actually, after the hostilities, Israel systematically went out and destroyed the villages. There was one that was just destroyed in the last 6 months here in Jerusalem, the last houses. So it had nothing to do with security. House demolitions, and that's a key point that we'll come back to, has nothing to do with security. They're not houses of terrorists. They're not houses that are targeted. There's no security issue. There's simply, of course, in 47-48, the idea was to prevent the return of refugees. If you have nowhere to return to, you can't come back, and to take their lands. Today, in the occupied territory, the intention is to push the Palestinians into these tiny areas A and B, and to confine them there and take their land and so on. So what we're talking about is many more than 100,000 homes of people that have been demolished by Israeli government since the beginning of the state. So this is like the essence of the conflict, because it's really, it gets down to the whole, can the two peoples even exist together? And from a Zionist Israeli point of view, the answer is no. I don't care what Zionist ideology says, this whole concept of Jewish democracy or what the Declaration of Independence says, in fact, on the ground in terms of policy, Israel goes on demolishing Palestinian homes. And I want to emphasize that, in fact, Israel demolishes more homes of Israeli citizens today, who are Arabs, of course, inside Israel, than it does in the occupied territories. Last year, three times more homes were demolished inside Israel of Israeli Arab citizens than were in the occupied territory. So it's happening throughout the country. It's a part of what we have a term for it in Israel, Judaization. We're Judaizing the country. It's a formal government term. And so house demolitions really means the displacement of an entire people out of their country. And I think it very clearly delineates the parameters of the conflict. So house demolitions for us then is this has become, like I said, a vehicle for understanding where Israel's going. Why is it demolishing homes? And also for exposing what's going on. We, for example, rebuild homes as political acts of resistance. We built 187 homes in couple of weeks, we're going to build a couple more. We raise money from people all over the world. People come to build with us. And we rebuild homes as political acts of resistance, not humanitarian, but that also say to the Palestinians, we as Israelis, we raise the money. We bring the people. We build the homes. We as Israelis reject the idea of exclusivity, and that you have no place, and this country is only the land of Israel that only belongs to Jews. So I think it's a very crucial and important and symbolic act of resistance, rebuilding of homes. And so in a sense, like I said, it's a vehicle, because now that we know how it's done and why it's done and who's doing it, we really know how the occupation works. We can also tell Israel's intentions. Where is Israel going? And it's clear from what it's doing on the ground. I mean, house demolitions is part of what Israel calls creating facts on the ground that make its presence throughout the country, the Judaization of the entire country, permanent. And it follows very much Jabotinsky's idea of the Iron Wall, that you create such a permanent, massive Zionist presence in the country that the Arabs, as we call them, we don't use the word Palestinians, the Arabs will simply give up in despair. That's the idea. And so in a sense, it is the essence of the conflict, but it also begins to give us an idea of, well, okay, if we want to get out of this mess, if we want to achieve a just peace, what's possible? You know, the two-state solution has certainly been on the agenda. But if you look at the facts on the ground, house demolitions and so on, and Israel's intentions through that, it's clear that's gone. So the house demolition issue has been a very powerful and, I think, insightful kind of a way to enter into the conflict.
Yeah, I think so, too. It's something that I grabbed onto when I first arrived here, is knowing that was happening. So I live right next to East Jerusalem, and being able to go and stand in solidarity with people who are getting forcibly evicted or whose houses are getting demolished. It's definitely being sort of the top of the flow chart, and everything comes under that. But now I'm trying to figure out if there's a way to draw connections or similarities and differences, some kind of mapping like that that you can do between all the occupied territories, like between the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza? Because I find in most conversations, it's either we end up talking just about Gaza or just about Jerusalem or just about the West Bank, and it's hard to understand this comprehensive picture of the mechanisms that are keeping the occupation present, like intact in all the occupied territories. And I want to know if it's possible to understand them in a more holistic manner.
Well, you know, again, I think occupation is a term we have to move beyond, because it continues to indicate that that these are parts of the country that are extraneous or on the side or can be dispensed with, and they're not. In other words, Israel and this policy of Judaization that's ongoing shows that. The entire land of Israel is ours. If you want to take the perspective, really, of the Israeli government for all these years, and the whole thrust of the economic policy, the political policy, the movement of populations in and out, it all shows that, we don't even use the word occupation. You know, Israel denies officially, in official circles internationally, that there is an occupation. Because Israel says you can't occupy your own country. This is our country. So there is no occupation. And we don't use those words. We don't use the word West Bank in Israel. You use, even on the news, you use the term Judea and Samaria. You don't talk about East Jerusalem. Nobody in the Israeli Jewish society would talk about East Jerusalem. East Jerusalem is, it's Jerusalem. You live in Jerusalem. You know, and if you press someone and you say, yeah, but isn't there an East Jerusalem somewhere? And I say, well, okay, maybe that's where Arabs live. But in fact, you know, there's more Israeli Jews living in what's called East Jerusalem than there are Palestinians. In neighborhoods like Pisgat Ze'ev and Neve Yaakov, huge neighborhoods, this is more than 100,000 people, are to the east of Beit Hanina and Shuafat, which are East Jerusalem. So there is no East Jerusalem, not politically, not geographically, not demographically. The only part that Israel would get rid of, and is trying actually, is Gaza. It doesn't want Gaza. The settlers use up all the water in Gaza. I mean, you have, you know, the UN says by the year 2022, Gaza will be uninhabitable. And Israel doesn't want that headache. So it's trying very much to either push it on to Egypt, and Egypt doesn't want it, or there's this cockamamie idea of creating an independent state in Gaza, where Egypt would give a certain piece of land in the Sinai, and they'd put it together. It's crazy.
I don't think I've heard of that one.
No, there's a plan like that. And in compensation, Egypt would get a corridor around Eilat. That would, so Egypt could connect up to Jordan. That's the idea. And then if they would give up a piece of Gaza, of Sinai, to connect to Gaza. But Egypt doesn't need that corridor. I mean, it can get to Jordan very easily. It's a whole non-starter, but it shows the nuttiness of Israeli policymakers that really have no sense of where they are. That's another story. Now, in Oslo, in the Oslo agreements, that still, to some degree, define terms, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza are to be considered one integral area. In fact, you really shouldn't use the word occupied territories. You should say occupied territory, because Gaza and the Palestinians really fight for that, not to disconnect Gaza. Israel, of course, is and does. But in fact, what I would go again and say is that the whole idea of occupation is something that Israel doesn't accept. And I would even go so far as to say the Labour Party has bought into that as well. We have to remember that this whole occupation began with the Labour Party. The settlements began with Labour. The wall is a Labour Party initiative. It wasn't. Sharon actually was against the wall. And it was forced on him by Paris and the Labour Party. the economic closure, house demolition. In other words, all the major elements of occupation, in fact, were not only begun by Labour, but have been pursued by Labour more quickly when they're in power than by the Likud. So Labour is a full partner in this. So basically, you have a consensus almost in Israel among the political parties, certainly the major political parties, that in one way or another, this is going to stay one country. I mean, nobody in the Labour Party is going to give up the Jordan Valley. Nobody's going to give up East Jerusalem. Nobody's going to give up Maale Adumim or Ariel. Or have, you know, if you take it piece by piece, even Labour, its view of a two-state solution is one of little Palestinian cantons, not a real viable Palestinian state. So you could say that in terms of a genuine Palestinian state, even a tiny one, I mean, the two-state solution was viable. It could have been done if the Palestinians had actually gotten the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, which, as we know, is only 22% of historic Palestine. So you often hear about Ehud Barak's generous offers, this big argument of how generous we were. But we never hear about the Palestinians' generous offer. A colonized people that gives up political claim to 78% of its country to its colonizers and says, we will make peace with you for the 22% that remains. Well, that's unprecedented. Israel could have had, if it keeps telling us it wants peace and security, it could have had that 1988, you know, 30 years ago, the Palestinians accepted the two-state solution formally. So Israel could have had peace, security, and 78% of the country 30 years ago. Imagine where we could have been today. Imagine how that could have influenced the whole wider Middle East if that had happened. Instead, we decided, for whatever reasons, that we wanted the whole country. And that's what we're pursuing until today. So that the facts on the ground, I think, Israeli government policy and the lack of will in the international community to put any meaningful pressures on Israel to withdraw, especially in Canada, but certainly in the United States as well, and in Germany and other European countries, means that basically Israel wins. I think Israel's won. Today, it's completed. It's completed the Judaization process. The entire country is the land of Israel. There's only one government between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. There's only one army, obviously. There's only one currency, one highway system, one electrical system, one water system. By any measure, this is today one country. The whole debate, should there be two countries or one country, is over. There is one country, and it's called Israel. But it's an apartheid state. It's an apartheid state, and I'm not saying that in a polemic kind of a way. In international law, apartheid means two things. There's two elements to apartheid. One is when one population separates itself from the others. That's the apartness, which Israel has obviously done. I mean, just look at the flag of the country, and you see it only has the symbol of one of the groups living in the country. And then when that dominant population that separates itself from the others creates a regime of permanent institutionalized domination. In other words, it's not Jim Crow. It's not just discrimination. You have discrimination everywhere. But it's when that's the law of the system. The system is, the country is, the laws are based on privileging one group over the others. That's apartheid. And it doesn't matter if it's based on race or religion or ethnicity or the color of your eyes. Once you have a regime of separation and domination, that's apartheid. And that's what we have. And so in a sense, Israel has eliminated the two-state solution. A long time ago, Israel eliminated the idea that there was an occupation in the first place. And by its facts on the ground that are so massive, Israel has really eliminated any chance of eking out even a mini Palestinian state from this 22%. And that's the reality that I think our work on house demolitions and our getting to know the lay of the land has really taught us. Which means then that part of our job as Israeli activists has to be working with our Palestinian partners and trying to work with our Israeli partners to formulate how do we get out of this mess beyond the two-state solution. And that's where I go back to this issue of being a Zionist. Because if you're a Zionist, you can't do it. You're stuck. You're trapped because Israel has to be a Jewish state, which is a problematic concept in the first place. But you could have finessed it a little bit with a two-state solution. You can't finesse it once you control the entire country. And so we have to go beyond that, really, to post-Zionism. Again, I say Israel remains Israel, not as a state, but it becomes transformed into a binational state. And Canada isn't a bad example. Canada is actually a tri-national state. I mean, if you take the Anglophones, the Francophones, and the First Nations, I mean, you have, at least on paper, and the Francophones is not just on paper. The province of Quebec has a parliament. It has a lot of economic authority in terms of immigration policies and economic policies and so on. It's got institutions. It has its language. You've built into Canada. I mean, I know it's not perfect.
There's definitely a lot of issues with the indigenous.
No, of course. And with the indigenous, of course, there's tremendous issues. I mean, nowhere is it really, there's always those tensions. But in principle, at least, you've accepted, you've bitten that bullet, and you've accepted that. And what I'm saying is that there are models, the UK and Spain, and there's a lot of places that are models of binational or multinational countries that function.
So do you think it's possible to have a sense of a Jewish nation or a Jewish sensibility in a one state that's shared with Palestinians?
Yes, because the one state that we're advocating for is democratic. Mm-hmm. Everybody has, again, think of Canada. Everybody has equal rights in a democracy, but it's also binational. There's two pillars to it. In other words, you have to, I think, recognize, and it's not easy for either the Israelis or the Palestinians to do this, that there are two nations, two peoples, with competing claims to self-determination living in this country. And I think what Canada shows, what the UK shows for, and others, is that you can have a good measure of self-determination without it ending up necessarily as independence. The difficulty here is that unlike Canada and Belgium and the UK and other, you don't have discrete areas. Here the Israelis live here, the Palestinians live there. We're all mixed, which makes it much more difficult. But nevertheless, the principle of binationalism, you could create a national chamber of the parliament. You could have national universities like the Hebrew University and the Palestinian National University. You could have national museums. Both languages could be respected in law. You could create a system in which people feel that, yes, my collective rights, my collective identity is being honored and acknowledged. And then within that, to begin to simply live together in a democratic country. There are precedents. It's not like some completely crazy idea. There's been a lot of countries like that, including South Africa. Mm-hmm. I mean, in South Africa, both the Afrikaners and the Zulu consider themselves separate nations. They don't consider themselves merely South Africans. But nevertheless, they've been brought in to that process and today function within South Africa. So I think it's possible to do.
I've been fortunate enough to talk to a lot of people who, were around before there was a wall and they're living and, they'd go to Bethlehem for fun. People come here and this and that. And there was a sense of being able to not necessarily talk or have real relationships between Jews and Arabs, but just being around each other's presence. Mm-hmm. And now I'm trying to imagine like a younger generation who's grown up in this picture the way it is now, then all that becoming dismantled if there was a one-state solution.
Sure.
And how would that actually look like? What would Bethlehem look like with a wall coming down and with transportation going between and no checkpoints? Like how do you actually make this happen in not in a necessarily legislative and policy way, but in like the cultural climate and the socialization kind of way? Like I think I'm pessimistic and imagine lots of violence and weird things happening for the first while. But why?
That's the way we live.
Yeah.
For the first 40 years of occupation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, between 1967 and maybe the first 30. 1967 and the closure of the West Bank began, ironically, the beginning of the Oslo peace process. So around 1993, something like that. So between 1967 and the early 1990s, it was exactly as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was open. The Palestinians could take the kids to the beach. They worked in Tel Aviv and stuff. I mean, the people in Gaza, until today, the older people all know Hebrew, the men, because they all worked in Tel Aviv. And like you said, you know, people would go shopping in the old city. You know, Nazlat Issa is a huge market up in the northern part of the West Bank where everybody from northern Israel would come buy furniture and shop and everything. Big Jala here was a place where people used to go buy antique furniture, used to go buy wine. I mean, there was all that mixture existed. I mean, I'm not saying it was all idyllic. It didn't always, result in friendships and we weren't, but nevertheless, there was a great degree of coexistence. And of course, with the closure and the real enforced separation, that has really created a problem because the young generation of Palestinians has never met Israelis,
mm-hmm.
doesn't know Hebrew, has never had that experience that their parents had. It'd really take a while, except, I don't know, I'm an optimist, I guess. You have to be if you're going to be a political activist. You know, I think that I'm just saying this to give an idea. This isn't a scientific thing, but I think, for example, the hatred or the animosity between the Irish and the English, or the Scots and the English, is greater than that between the Israelis and the Palestinians. I think the hatreds between the Germans and the Poles, or the Poles and the Russians, or the Germans and the French, are much deeper. They have a lot of history, a lot of bad things. You know, that's very deep. it's deeper than, you know. I think the problem with the Israelis, if I can say this on a podcast, is they don't give a shit. They just don't. They don't hate Arabs. They just don't care.
Mm-hmm.
And from the Palestinian point of view, I think they're fine with coexistence. They learn Hebrew. They work with Israelis. They know Israelis to some degree. So I think the Palestinians are really pissed off at us because they know that we know that they're not all terrorists and that they haven't rejected the peace and that we use all these things. We use them as a foil so that we can keep control. They know that they're being used by us. And that really outrages them. But that deep-seated hatred that comes from some historical is still missing. And there's animosity and there's wounds. And certainly the refugee issue is crucial. You cannot resolve this conflict without the right of return. And Israel has to acknowledge what it did as well. But given those kinds of things, I think actually coexistence here is much easier than it was in South Africa or a lot of other places. And in fact, I think, if you look at the Oslo peace process, you know, the minute it was declared, it was like a jack-in-the-box. Boom. All of a sudden, there's plans 2 days after the thing is signed to turn the Dead Sea into a casino zone between Jordan and the Palestinian Authority in Israel. You know, a joint airport was going to be built between Eilat and Aqaba. The Sea of Galilee was going to become another free zone, a peace park up in the Golan Heights. All of a sudden, all these plans, boom, show up. They're in the drawer. And I think even today, in a way you don't see it, I think a lot of Israeli business people work together. Israeli and Palestinian business people work together. Certainly the security forces work together. So there is a basis. And in fact, I think the Palestinian economy is even adapted, and the Israeli economies are complementary. You know, Palestinians are very involved in high tech. They're very active economically and in business, you know, and they really, in a sense, conduct a lot of the business, not only in the Middle East, but of Latin America. So they have a very rich and very educated diaspora, the Palestinians. They have a lot of resources, so that putting the peoples together isn't going to be like, you know, pushing the black Africans into some kind of false equality with white South Africans, where they become an underclass. The Palestinians have a lot of resources. And again, you know, there is a certain amount of coexistence here. So I think, I can be optimistic about it. If we can find that political way out, I think the actual implementation of a peace thing would be very easy. I think these two peoples would come together for... even now, as we're speaking, Israel made a decision to open up all the checkpoints in Ramadan. I mean, Colombia, you can't get through this stuff. So that now everybody, almost all the Palestinians without a permit, for the first time in years, can go to Tel Aviv and go visit relatives in the country. And I'll tell you, this happened 2 years ago in Ramadan. It wasn't announced like it was this year. It wasn't announced. Simply one day in the Eid, for one day after Ramadan, 2 years ago, Israel opened the checkpoints. Didn't announce it was going to do it, and it went from word of mouth to word, and thousands of people went. So all of a sudden, one day, this is 2013, you get thousands of Palestinians in Tel Aviv. The first thing they did is they went shopping. BDS or no. The first thing they did is visit the relatives. Second thing is they went shopping, BDS or no BDS.
Yeah.
And then they went to the beach. So all of a sudden, you're sitting in Tel Aviv, and here's thousands of Palestinians on the beach and the coffee shops. And it went absolutely quiet. Nobody said a word. There wasn't an incident. Nobody complained. Well, they were there. They got their coffee and they got their tea and they went to the beach and they went home.
Mm-hmm.
So there is, I think, if you go beyond the rhetoric of the government, and it's a right-wing ideology, and so on, and the fact that the Israelis just don't care about Arabs, which is true, you have certain foundations anyway for a coexistence that I think have to be recognized as well. They're a part of the equation.
Yeah, I guess for me, thinking about how the economies would come together, how people would work together. I'm thinking mostly about how mostly it's like Arab labor for Israelis, and you know, the Israelis are kind of the managers and the workers are Arab or Palestinian, and that would have to be balanced out somehow.
But I think it would balance out.
Yeah.
I mean, do you know there are today more Palestinian students in universities than there are Israeli students in universities?
Hmm.
They're very educationally minded, the Palestinians, as they have a lot of them have left the country because they have nothing to do with their education. It's true, there's no occupation, there's no economy under occupation. And today they're the workers in Israel, and those that can get in, or in East Jerusalem. But I think that that opening this up, I think in a fairly short time, there might not be an absolute parity. That'll take a little longer, but I think the Palestinians would do fine. You know, again, there's a lot of educated people. The economy would grow tremendously. They would really be the bridge to the Arab world to a large degree. So I can see a lot of partnerships with Israelis. And also, again, they've got this whole diaspora as a resource.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just like And you saw it after the Oslo thing was signed, thousands of Palestinians living abroad invested here. They invested in companies, including Israeli companies. They built, you know, villas in there. They started to develop their villages. You know, they wanted to have summer homes here. Some of them wanted to move back here. I mean, you know, there was a lot of, and I think that their diaspora, just like the Jewish diaspora in terms of Israel, would kick in as well. So I think they have a lot going for them. And again, I think, I mean, it's hard to kind of say this today, but I think the Israelis have also been Middle Easternized to some degree. You know, it isn't like in South Africa. I think the Israelis, with the Mizrahi Jews and just living here, have become to some degree, have moved towards the Arab community in certain ways. And there's some affinities, that's what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. And the Palestinians also know Israelis. They don't always like what we do, but they know us. And so I think there's more of a foundation for coexistence than the political right-wing dynamics of Israeli governments will indicate to us.
So one question on the right of return. I haven't done too much researching into this. I don't really know what people are offering as a way to make it happen or what the mm-hmm. demands are exactly, but how would you imagine right of return working in a sense that to do that you'd also be end up displacing people who are, you know, Jewish or Israeli yeah. in homes, and how does that create its own map? How does it work with settlement movement and
Well, you know, the first of all, like I said, you're not gonna get anywhere without the right of return.
Yeah.
Half the Palestinians are refugees outside. Many more than half are refugees internally. So that the refugee issue is really a crucial one. But there's some flexibility here. First of all, there's a research. There's a fellow named Salman Abu Sita, a Palestinian researcher, who says that 85% of the lands that were taken from the Palestinians in 1948 are still available. They're either farmland, mm-hmm. and you see in the edges of kibbutzim and stuff, the ruins of a few Palestinian houses that they use for this or that, a barn or something like that. Or they're under parks. You see, in other words, it hasn't, that most of the land that they come from hasn't been built upon. Even today, you know, that's where Israel is very concerned. Only about half the population of the Galilee is Jewish. So you have huge areas in the Galilee and in the Negev and other parts of the country in which refugees could actually return. They might not return to their specific homes, but you know, land is there. And in fact, there's a whole, you know, Zohrot, which is an organization dedicated to remembering the Nakba and to actually achieving the right of return, has done a few conferences. There's a whole generation of young Israeli-Palestinian architects that have come up with all kinds of plans of how to revive Palestinian villages. You know, Israel has, in all these years since 1948, hasn't built one new Arab city or town or village. It hasn't allowed any development to happen. It's all crowded and so on. So the idea is, a little bit compensation for that. You know, they have plans for partly reviving the Arab communities that exist and expanding them, but in ways that integrate traditional architectural elements with modern elements as well. Really, you know, very, not just the, let's go build another stone house here, but very sophisticated urban planning things for integrating the refugees in a way that actually addresses the gaps in the Israeli infrastructure, rather than, now, you would need, of course, you would need a land redistribution, some degree. Financial compensation would come in. If you can't get, you know, if you can't get your own home back in your own land, you have to be compensated or given another home. In other words, a lot of work would have to be done. Maybe some integrated communities would arise, but all that is very doable. So if there's goodwill, I think the refugee issue, and then, you know, again, some refugees come back. Now, Khalil Shkaki, who's a Palestinian sociologist, has done research among the refugees, and he claims that not more than 10% would actually come back, in which case we're talking about maybe 500,000, mainly older people, actually. So it might not be such a huge issue anyway. A lot of the refugees, I think, would like financial compensation and go to Canada, go to Australia, go to other places to restart their lives. Others, you know, for example, those in Jordan that have been there for all these years, that have businesses that are established, would, again, with compensation, would stay where they are. So I think the compensation idea, but the idea of choice, the idea is that Israel says you have a right to return. This isn't a humanitarian gesture. You have a right to return, is your choice. If you choose to return, we will do everything we can in good faith to create conditions for adequate resettlement. If you choose not to, you'll get financial compensation wherever you want to go and so on. But I think it's a very doable thing, the right of return. But it means that Israel has to, and that again, it contradicts this whole thing of Zionism and exclusivity, and because the idea is that this country cannot be exclusively Jewish. We would really have to be binational.
Mm.
And that's a hard bullet for Israelis to bite.
Indeed. So I feel like I could talk to you for a very long time, but
yes,
it
you
has
already
been
have
going
talked
on.
To me for a very long time.
And just, I feel like it's flying by. So I think I just want to ask you what you think the role is of American Jews in all of this, whether it's North America on title or just USA. And I don't know if you want to separate that between people who have made Aliyah and who are here, or people that are still living in the U.S. But what is the role in ending the occupation, or what should people be doing? What's your message?
Well, you know, the American and Canadian Jewish communities have not played a good role so far in terms of bringing about a just peace. They give, even the liberal Zionists are still Zionists. In other words, I think my message is that we have to go beyond Zionism. Progressive Zionism is a contradiction in terms. Zionism is based on the idea of exclusivity. It always has been. And it's created what we call an ethnocracy. The idea that a country belongs to one particular group. And you just look at the flag again and you see that. It's up front, it's in your face, it isn't something you hidden. And Zionism can't go anywhere else. This whole idea of somehow of a Jewish democracy is ridiculous. Once you start qualifying democracy, it's not a democracy. So Zionism still matters and it's still important in a binational framework. If Zionism can retool and can say, okay, what would a meaningful national Jewish life look like in a binational country? To go back to what used to be called cultural Zionism. Political Zionism of exclusivity has exhausted itself. And there's nowhere else to go. There's nothing to offer us. Cultural Zionism of Buber and Magnus and Henrietta Zold and some of these others, that's really the way to go. They were right. They were simply intellectuals that weren't organized. So I think liberal Zionists today, if they really wanted to play a constructive role, would say, okay, how could we build a binational democratic country in Israel and Palestine that would respect the collective and individual rights of everyone? And being Americans and Canadians, I would say even Canadians more because of your experience. But as Americans and Canadians with experience in multicultural, pluralistic democracies, you have a lot to offer. So why, and Zionism, in fact, if you really think about it, Zionism itself is the antithesis of American Jewish values. I mean, it's based, I mean, if anything, American Jews are founded on the idea of social justice and the prophets and human rights and social rights and civil rights. I mean, that's, so to turn around and say, well, an ethnocratic, you know, idea of an exclusive Jewish state in which Arabs are either thrown out or put in apartheid state cantons, that's what we're, I mean, even the Jews can't accept that. But I think American Jews have to assert that they're Zionists, if they want to call themselves that, that believe in a national existence for Jews in this country, because we do have a tie to this country, but recognize the fact that there's also a Palestinian people living here, something we should have done 100 years ago. We have to do a lot to rectify all the crimes and sins that we've done over the last century to them, and eventually to work with them to set up a binational state in this country. I think it's a challenge. I don't see it as a threat. I don't see it as something negative. I think it's something that liberal Zionists, actually, this should be their agenda. This is where they could really contribute to turning this country into a prosperous, peaceful, just, you know, land of coexistence between two peoples. That's their, that would be their mission if I had to define a mission for them. But they're far from it today.
I think it all starts with education and really taking social responsibility.
Yeah, and intellectual honesty.
Yeah.
You gotta, you know, they're bullshitting themselves, the liberal Zionists. You know, they're taking all these things, and they're cutting out and ignoring all the, or trying to excuse, and all the crimes and all the, you know, and the structural reasons why the conflict exists, instead of biting the bullet and saying, okay, let's be honest. And we really have to admit that these are the elements of Zionism that are destructive, that have to change. And if they do, and as American Jews, we have a lot of clout in Israel. If they do, all kinds of new possibilities open up for peace that don't exist as long as you buy into this exclusive Zionist idea. So, you know, you have to create a situation where liberal Zionism is not a contradiction of terms.
And did you want to make a plug for your building camp?
And, you know, part of our, like I said, our resistance politically to occupation is rebuilding Palestinian homes. So on July 19th, we're having our 13th annual work camp where people come from all over the world to build with us. And everybody's invited. It costs something because we have to buy the materials. But it's a wonderful experience for 2 weeks. You start with a ruined, demolished house that the Israeli authorities demolished. And in 2 weeks, you give the key to the family and help them move in their furniture. We're building this year for a family with 11 children that are living almost outside because the Israelis demolished their home. So it's a very moving and a very, I think, meaningful, politically a meaningful kind of a thing. So if anybody's interested, they should be in touch with me, jeff@icads.org, I-C-A-H-D, or look on our website. But at any rate, I hope everyone joins the cause.
Beautiful. Okay, well, thank you very much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, see you later.